Hey, this is Russell, and I work at the video store, the place that we can all go to every week when it's movie night. On days like today, our interesting customers pop in to rent something, and we go through the films that they've loved across their life. All right, let's do it. Let's open up the shop.
Did you see that thing yesterday on the TV?
Good morning.
Morning, Russell.
How are you, G-Force?
I'm good, dude. How are you?
I'm lekker, man. Today's going to be a good day.
Yes.
Do you want to know why?
I do know why. It's exciting.
Today is a guest episode. So for those very new to the video store, welcome. Welcome to our video store. Thank you for wandering in. Our main output is a Tuesday episode with myself and Graham, and there's a whole bunch of other folks you'll come to know. And we are behind the counter talking about the movies and the series that we're watching.
Yeah.
And that comes out on a Tuesday. But every now and again, one of our special customers at the video store pop in to say hi. They're probably returning something or looking for something to rent. And this comes out on a Thursday, an occasional Thursday. Today is one of those days. we have the celebrated, loved, you know, absolutely important political satirist and activist Zapiro.
Yeah.
Popping in.
It's awesome.
He is very much a household name, but for those who perhaps don't, I don't know where you've been, but he is a cartoonist, a very famous cartoonist who's been a very important part of telling South Africa's story.
Yeah.
Through major newspapers over the years, and has always been there to comment and give his opinion, and also help keep in check.
Yes,
some of our politicians, especially in this country, but has always been there to sort of mark amazing moments. And an incredible documentary called "The Showerhead" has been made, and is in select cinemas around the country at the moment. Most importantly, at the Bioscope.
Most importantly.
And we've had an amazing response to it.
Nice.
So we're going to get into that, and I want to talk to him about the film. But effectively, The Showerhead is all about Zuma and Zuma's legacy and his relationship to Zapiro over the years, where Zapiro put this iconic shower on the head of Jacob Zuma to have us remind, you know, ourselves about some of the moments that Zuma has had in our history. And the film is an incredible reminder of that. So screenings are on sale even in the week that this episode comes out and further dates. So tickets for that are at thebioscope.co.za. But for those who are unfamiliar, we're going to go through Zapiro's life, and we're going to go through the films that he's loved, and it's such a great way to see a different side of him. Because if you do know Jonathan, and you do know his work, I think you're going to learn a little more, something a little different. So I can see him come now; he's on his way in.
Amazing.
He lives in Cape Town, so this is this is going to be a little digital pop in, so to speak. We're going to chat over Zoom, but let's get into it.
Nice.
All right. This is Zapiro popping in to rent something. How's it?
Yeah, good.
How's everything?
Well, let me tell you, it's kind of amazing, actually going to a movie house and see, I went to the lobby to see Beetlejuice, and, there's my movies playing, my movie.
The movie about you,
About me playing in one of the movie houses there. It's great, and also it's alternating with Beetlejuice in Screen One at different times, which my son went to see it yesterday evening, and which was great. He was away when the first screenings happened, and so he's seen it for the first time. Yeah.
And what did he think of it?
But he really liked it. He really liked it. He's someone who's done reviews for Daily Maverick, and he's won awards for his reviews. So I kind of obviously I there's a kind of an emotional response that he has as my son, but he really liked the movie, and we had a whole discussion about all kinds of things.
Was there
some of the devices?
How old is he now? If he's writing reviews for Daily Maverick, he's obviously not too young. How old is he now?
Yeah, he's 29. He's not doing so much for that now. He did it for a while, and he got a couple of awards for his writing, and specifically on movies. So he was doing what we're watching. So he's talking about movies. He's talking about screening platforms. He was like YouTube sensations, all kinds of things. He was casting around. So he's got a very strong interest in this sort of thing as well.
What was the age that just broke up as you said it?
Oh, he's 29.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what I loved about the movie, and I'm curious whether he picked these sorts of things up, is that we needed a refresher because as South Africans, we forgot. You know, I said to someone the other day in the lobby, you know, we're so focused on the literal and the figurative pothole in front of us, and we've got to concentrate while driving. We forget why that pothole was there, what led to it being so big, and why no one's fixed it yet. So
That's a good analogy. My son did pick that up. I mean, he said something to the effect that I know a lot of this stuff, you know, from following what you've been doing, but to see it all in that kind of sequence and to see it put together in this coherent way with the cartoons, it is kind of like a refresher course, and I can see that as well. My daughter also. And many of my friends who've also, some of whom are involved in journalism and others who just, you know this stuff and are pretty well informed, are seeing things that they, hadn't quite remembered in that sequence or in that kind of comprehensive analysis.
Just that the biggest thing for me was those 700 charges that Zuma had against him before he became president. And of course, you know, politicians around the world will always be corrupt. They might get charged or they might get a sentence, but the fact that all got squashed moments before just so that he could become president was the most compromising. I mean, you can expect politicians to be corrupt, but the country was corrupt in that moment, and so the showerhead just became such a simple document. And I just think it's so great that this kind of very clear, just from the start to the end, we had this timeline and we had your artifacts, your work that was able to be these stamps and be these the chronicling of this, you know, this presidency. So how long did this film involve you? Because there was, you know, there was the early interview, which you get the impression took place a little while ago, and then they were able to kind of film you again in a more recent time. When did this start for you?
It started for me in 2016.
Jeez, but, as further back as that.
Yeah. But Craig Tanner, the director, has told me in a couple of public forums as well that it started quite a bit earlier than that, and I hadn't quite cottoned on because, you know, I get so many different kinds of requests from all sorts of different people that, you know, before I knew who Craig was and before I'd kind of quite figured out what he wanted to do. I mean, he says that he had contacted me quite some time before that, and I hadn't quite latched onto it. And I believe him because that's the kind of thing that happens. I mean, involved in the sort of hurly-burly of stuff. So I'm not sure exactly when it was, but before 2016. Then we had to do quite some arranging for him to come to South Africa from Sydney. I mean, he lives in Sydney, Australia. Mm-hmm. He moved from South Africa in 2008. So in 2016, he arrived, and we did the first long interview or series, a few interviews there. And he then went and interviewed other people who appear in the movie, a number of them in Johannesburg, because, you know, some of the publications I saw were actually in Johannesburg. Maundly Makanya in particular, because Maundly was the, you know, editor of the Sunday Times and the Lady Justice drawing appeared when he was editor. So we can speak about Maundly. There's a lot there. But actually, there's Craig, very, he handled the sort of second and third interviews very well, because there's actually a second time where he interviews me after 2016, and you don't really notice it because he kind of got the continuity very, very close.
Okay, I didn't pick that up.
And then 2018, and then a bit later than that, when I looked completely different, and I had lost a lot of weight, I'd grown a beard, I got more bald, et cetera, et cetera. And then we got the whole continuity of the story to kind of explain that a lot of time had passed.
It's great. And as I said, it's just this perfect reminder. The whole time when you're watching it, you obviously feel this relationship between you and Zuma. I'm curious whether you've ever met him in real life.
I have been very close to him in the same room on a number of occasions and decided not to go and meet him. Most of those times were when he was suing me in one or two cases. I know he's a big schmoozer. I didn't want to be schmoozed.
Exactly.
I was pissed off that he was suing me and other people.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, really angry with the guy. And I just didn't want to have a situation where I'm forced to be polite to him in a sort of a group situation.
Yeah.
Because it would have been with a few other people around. What I did do, though, is in 2006, when he first sued me, I heard he was speaking at the Cape Town Press Club, and I got in with I got a sort of temporary press card. I'm a kind of, you know, sometime I don't know exactly what I am. I call myself a visual commentator. Occasionally I do get something like a press card.
Yeah.
So I went to actually confront him, and he gave a speech on freedom of expression and the free press. You know, so at the end of the thing, I mean, my hand shoots up along with a lot of other journalists. And when it gets to my turn, I say, you know, Zapiro, cartoonist, and I see his eyes kind of widen a little bit. And then I said, you know, you've just given a speech on freedom of the press and you support the free press, but you are suing people. And I'm not the only one you're suing. You're suing people who are criticizing you for things you've said and who are reporting on things that you've said.
Mm.
And that's hypocritical. And his answer was very, very difficult to pin down. He did that kind of mesmerizing us all with some kind of weird nothingness.
Yeah.
And that was very unsatisfying. But I did then, in 2008, when he sued me again, he was on Riddy Clubby's show on the radio. And I called the producers and I said, please jump me over. I don't usually ask this, but I want to speak to him. Yeah. And they were very happy to get me on. And I said, he wasn't president. No, was he president? I can't remember.
Yeah.
He was by the time. He was not president when he sued me either time.
Yeah.
But so shortly after he sued me, I think he came in relatively shortly. I mean, he came in as president to that radio station. I said to him, Mr. President, I asked you when you first sued me, why are you doing that in 2006? Now I'm asking you again. You're suing me again. And this time he said, I saw your cartoons, you are invading my dignity, which is a fantastically weird quote. So I just put that on the back of my next book.
That's right. It's one of your quotes. Okay, so yeah, so there has been these moments, because it's lovely that the two can completely exist on their own. You know, he can be the president doing what he did, and then you can be quite objectively commenting and criticizing him throughout. My other question to you is, obviously you've got to stay very plugged in. does that get taxing, sort of remaining so plugged in? Because when I think of not just, you know, the deadlines that you have to do, you know, you're talking about being in these, you know, being sued for me, that weighs on me personally. I struggle to do long fights. I can do a short fight. You know, I've got the aptitude to do that. But I mean, a lot of these are quite long fights. But remaining so plugged into the South African politics, aren't there some times where you need to sort of bow out? How do you balance that?
It hasn't been so hard for me to stay plugged into what's going on. I think that's part of my makeup. I mean, I think ever since I became an activist in the 80s, in the 1983, when the United Democratic Front formed, I really have been very passionate about what's happening. I really want to be able to communicate things about it, and I'm, you know, cartooning is my genre, and I'm always interested. So that's not so tough. The other thing that you mentioned, though, the deadlines. In the 40 years that I've been doing this, I've never really got on top of deadlines. I really haven't. It's the most difficult thing to. When I used to do 6 cartoons a week, year in and year out, I battled like hell, but I had to get those cartoons out.
Yeah,
I do fewer now. But the deadlines have really, they've taken their toll on me, that's for sure.
Yeah. And what are some of your challenges when you do hit those blocks? Because I'm sure there's some weeks where you have to fulfill, right? Perhaps you're struggling. Where do you go in your process?
One thing that is, I say this and it sounds glib, but it's actually true, I think, for all sorts of creative processes is that sometimes you've got to get the hell out of your workspace and go and do something else for a little while, whether it's, a walk or a swim or a run or something like that, a cycle, or bizarrely for me, taking a shower. I mean, you know that there are actual studies that show that, you know what, people sing in the shower and people have ideas in the shower.
Yeah.
Something about that process, that cleansing thing, and that you sort of go in and it's short and sharp and I don't know, changes something in your head, freshens you up, and you people sing in the shower. It's kind of known. And then you kind of come out, which is, it's kind of nice and funny and cartoony for me that the shower is a place where I get an idea or get a shift or something. But it's true.
The idea of a shower has obviously been such a big part of your life because of the film The Showerhead. For those who don't know, is obviously the main point of the movie, which is the head that you placed above Zuma. And I must say, what I loved to get from the film, which was also a nice reminder, is that when he then went into his presidency, you symbolically removed the shower as a way of giving the post some respect, not necessarily the man. And then you taunted him by the fact that if he keeps screwing up, this shower head's going to be put back on. So it was was a very smart decision by you to sort of give the post some respect, which I thought was great.
Well, actually, I'll just say it was more about, it was less about giving the post some respect than giving him a chance, because despite the fact that I knew he was an absolutely corrupt person and should not have been in that position, I he's now there and I've got to kind of figure out like how to handle it, wanting him to succeed, even though I know I'm going to be there criticizing all the time.
Yeah.
So as I say, less about respect for the position, but I do have respect for the presidency, but it was really about sort of testing him and saying, okay, you're on probation, dude. Like,
yeah.
You stuff up, it'll come back again big time. And it's a game. It is a game, as I say in the movie.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on our current politics? What are your thoughts on the GNU? I'm curious to know what your, because you've got this much bigger picture. You know, you were a part of the struggle. You were there to usher in so much. I'm curious to know where your head's at now with this change in government.
Let me say something quickly before I say exactly what I think. Do you remember just how such a short time ago, as the people are talking about the GNU and that in itself, the new is kind of funny. I mean, it had been talked about in 1994, and Nelson Mandela had brought in a government of national unity in a very, very crucial situation where that was completely necessary to kind of somehow keep the right wing sort of as part of what was going on.
Okay, I didn't know that existed at that point. So there was that structure at that point.
Yes, that is the first new that we had is Nelson Mandela's government of national unity in 1994. Okay. That was okay. I mean, I didn't know of the term at all, or it wasn't, but that's where the new that I've been using now comes from. If you go back to my first collection and also the Democrazy, and my first collection is called the Madiba Years, and the second collection, which is called the Whole Truth. The new is there. That exact same character is now kind of resuscitated as Cyril's new. But he was there then, and it was very, very key. That, you know, at that stage, you are talking the ANC, which had won by a very big majority, but then they were bringing in the old National Party, and even Buthelezi, I mean, who is implacably opposed to the new constitution, you know, the constitution that was being developed, Mandela was very good at that kind of thing. So, I think Cyril was trying to draw on that sensibility when, you know, by the time the ANC now suddenly loses massively that majority and is now sitting, you know, just on 40%, he's trying to find a way. I did a cartoon where he, the new is referred to just in words, and you know it's the tent. He's got to keep the enemies in the tent pissing out rather than outside pissing in. The old Lyndon Johnson idea. So, but what I also want to point to is how people were freaking out that things were going to like fall apart. And I was asked in a couple of interviews, you know, are you worried? I said, no, I don't think so. I think they'll hold each other in check, the different parties, which is, you know, which is what is happening. You know, there are stresses and strains, but government is kind of working. The country itself is still in a very, very tough spot, and we've got a hell of a lot of work to do to get us out. But the government of national unity, or whatever, it's a kind of a glorified coalition, but it's working reasonably well, I think.
Yeah, it seems to be holding itself together, despite what many thought. I love to use the analogy that, you know, a party like the DA was always a very yappy dog next door that sort of barked through the fence. And now the dog's in the house. Still doesn't have...
Yep.
All that power, but it's at least barking from inside the property, which I think is great.
It kind of works both ways, because on the one hand, they've now all that yapping is, you know, they now have to actually sort of make some sense with the yapping. That's on, you know, so it's they get a chance to do that, but then they also have to figure out like at what point. Can they go along with certain things? At what point they kind of don't? I mean, it's very interesting. The Minister of Education, who's a DA minister, she didn't pitch up at the signing of the new Bella Bill because she doesn't agree with it, but she has to implement it, and she's committed to implement it. So those are the kinds of stresses and strains that happen in a government of national unity.
Speaking of yapping dogs, there was a point in the interview in the film, The Showerhead, and I thought it was a very interesting decision, and I wanted to check whether my theory is right. But, you know, when you're shooting an interview and you're on set, if a truck drives past or a plane flies over, you got to sort of stop and reshoot because it messes with the sound. So in the interview, a dog's barking. And I'm curious whether that was a decision, because I think it was at that time in the film they were speaking of you as a watchdog. Did I read too much into that, or did they just not exclude the dog?
I think you're reading too much into it, but okay. I think it's fun.
Because there was a point where I was like, why are they not stopping the interview and getting the dog quiet. But then I realized that there were even scenes where they could have very easily cut out a couple of dog barking. But then I realized, at least in my head, it amplified this scene that you were a watchdog in these moments.
You know how weird this is for me, because I have seen the movie three times, and I was so concerned about like what was being said, what was I saying, how it was, how the story was going. I kind of didn't notice the dog. The dog is my own dog.
Yeah.
And possibly because he sometimes does bark. I kind of didn't notice him in the movie. I'm sure I noticed him in the during the interviews, and I may have said like, should we get him out or something?
Yeah.
I don't really know.
I'm just curious whether that was a thought, because it wasn't. No. It was originally off-putting, but then I was like, I think this is part of building the tension in this moment.
It's so weird. Watching the video. Didn't notice it.
Where are you? I'm just curious. I always love sort of seeing where someone is right now. So on this Monday, what are your current deadlines? What are you in the process of right now? Is there a particular cartoon that you have to deliver now? Or have you just delivered? Where are you right now?
So I'm split between two or three things, which is very often what happens with me. So this morning when I got up, there is a cartoon that I know I want to do. Pravin Gordhan died on Friday, and I was busy doing because I'm finishing my latest annual, which, by the way, has a new on the cover. It is called Have I Got News For You.
Okay, I wanted to talk about the annual. Yeah, okay, but that's lovely.
But because I'm busy finishing it, I have finished the cover, but I'm still in that process of, I work with Mike Wills on the captions. The first, I think, 17 years, I did it all myself, but then I started working with Mike because it's a big help to have someone write the stuff, and then we kind of go through the whole thing and see, can you shorten it? What do we need? And well, I'm finishing the kind of the feeling of the book and the captions, based on what Mike's already written.
Okay.
So I was this morning, I got up, and that's what I'm doing. But I'm also thinking about Pravin Gordhan, which is what I was doing as I sat down to start speaking with you. Mm. I start doing little drawings, and I suddenly got a little idea which I'll be working with. I hope it's going to work out as something good.
Yeah, because building up to knowing I was going to chat to you, I heard that news, and immediately I've got a note here. Like, you're thinking about Pravin. he's someone that you might have to do some quick research on or call on stuff. Or...
Yeah. Actually, with Pravin, there's not a hell of a lot of research I have to do. You know, when you were talking earlier about the cartoons, and when you mentioned the charges, and you said 700. I mean, I know that it's 783 charges that Zuma had over his head. The cartoons almost provide this sort of filing cabinet in my head.
And I
know it's not it's not strange that I use a very archaic metaphor for that, because I am sort of old fashioned in that way, although I do digital things. But yeah, so I've got plenty stuff about Pravin in my head. Really a lot that I knew about him, that I've done cartoons about. But the day that he died, he died in the early hours of, or the late evening, I think, I can't remember, on Thursday evening or by Friday morning, it's news, but I'm still working on, because I was running slightly behind last week, I was still working on Trump and Kamala Harris.
Mm.
And I had a really nice image with this, actually it came from an idea that another Daily Maverick person, Tony Jackman, but it's raining cats and dogs.
Yeah,
and
I saw it. Yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah, and I was enjoying doing that drawing, but it took me the rest of the day to finish that.
Yeah.
So I'm now working only on the Pravin sort of homage today. Yeah.
Okay. When does the annual come out? And have you done an annual every year? That's the idea, right?
The annual comes out in October, October each year. And I did my first one in 1996. I slightly regret the fact that I didn't do one in 95, because by 1995 I certainly had enough cartoons for an annual, and so many of the ones that I really love from that period I never made it, because I had to, the very first one we had to decide how long it is, and so it's kind of 2.5 years worth of work,
yeah,
crammed into one annual. But yeah, 1996, the Madiba years, that's the first one. And then every year since then, I sit and think, what is like one of the biggest stories? What's going to make a good cover image? And yeah, and then I really enjoy coming up with those titles. I mean, if you look back through the now it's the 29th one. Mm. It's almost as kind of mark the different eras that we've been in.
Yeah.
And that's what I try and do with these annuals.
And we've got the majority, well, not the majority, but a big chunk of them in our gift shop, which was great. I'm a big fan of Shay from Jacana, and she was very good to give the Bioscope a whole bunch of stock for the gift shop. So we've been selling it now as part of the screenings and building up to the screenings. And it's so great. Once again, like the showerhead, you look back and you go, yes, I forgot about the Gupta wedding, you know, because that just was this completely opulent, crazy thing that just got the whole of South Africa thinking about them. It sort of put them on the radar, where everyone was like, wait, hold on, who's this? And then, you know, it exposed them in many ways. It started the exposing. So lovely. Okay, so what's this new one called?
The new one is called Have I Got News For You?
Yeah.
And it's the new running along, kind of making a little joke with the reader, and you see all the mayhem behind.
Lovely.
But just mentioning the books, okay, so this is the 29th annual, but what else you have there is the WTF.
Yes, and that one sells a lot. Yeah. We've been selling a lot of those copies.
Because I have, apart from these 29 annuals, I've done 4 specials. I did the big hardcover called the Mandela Files, and then I've done 3 in the same format, in a particular format, with quite a lot of content and thicker than my annuals. They look different and they feel different. And that is Vuvuzela Nation on sport, yeah, and 20 years of sport, then Democracy on 20 years of democracy, and then WTF, which is the book that I put together again with Mike Wills on essentially the Zuma story. It's essentially the essence of what is in the Showerhead movie.
Yeah,
it's the story of Zuma and the Guptas and state capture and my fights against Zuma and the lawsuits and lots of anecdotes, even more than we could. Can I tell you one anecdote that's in terms of Zuma? That there was just not enough time in the movie to tell some of these things. I mean, you were talking about the like connecting with Zuma and the charges and all of that. There's a story that is in the WTF, but not in the movie. In around 2015, I discovered through my friend Marianne Tam that Moketedi Mshe, who was the acting he was the head of the NPA, the acting head of the NPA in 2007.
Yeah.
When Zuma was not yet president, was trying to, in fact, become president of the ANC.
Mm.
And the charges were already around then. Moketedi Mshe told somebody, and it's documented. So whether it's true or not is not the point. The point is that he actually said that the reason he didn't charge Zuma with this in this huge case before the ANC's Polokwane conference in 2007 is that he saw this cartoon that I had done where Zuma's running like hell towards Polokwane and he's kind of leading the race of all these contenders for ANC presidency, but the closest person to him is Moketedi Mshe in sort of NPA outfit. All the others are in runners outfit. Moketedi Mshe is trying to pin the charges on him.
Yeah, like pinning him on his back.
Race number.
I remember that.
And Mokhtari and Mshe then went and said that he was so embarrassed when he saw the cartoon that he decided not to charge Zuma before Polokwane. I mean, imagine him saying that. I mean, because imagine if he had charged Zuma before Polokwane, it could have changed the course of history. But I mean, as I say, I don't even know if it's true or not. But the point that he said it meant that I then did another cartoon about that, and I said, well, don't blame me for Zuma. That's the weirdness of doing cartoons about these things.
But just the real life consequences of it, you know, in good ways where it feels like you did shift the dial, or in bad ways when you've got these threats, and it was great to have that documentary go into the times when you did feel like you were potentially under threat, which I think is amazing. I just think it's just such a good document to have, just like all your works. They'll just live on. And I've always been such a personal fan of the document. You know, I play in a band, but I take the most joy in knowing we published a song or published an album, or you know, you printed something. When I was in film school, I enjoyed the making of the DVD more than the film, you know, because I have this document. And so I just think it's so great that as a country we've got your artifacts, you know, we've got these documents. And I'll also never forget during COVID, people saying like they're collecting artifacts, you know, certain signs or certain things, or because this is a moment in history and these billboards or these street signs will become artifacts. And I just think that you contribute to that once a week, which is, you know, it has to be a very rewarding thing for you.
So. It's funny you mentioned a couple of things when you say once a week. I mean, these days it's like three times a week, but in the old days for me it was, you know, six times a week.
Really? As much as that, eh?
Oh, yeah, you know, for a decade I had this fantastic spread that was being in the Sowetan and the Mail and Guardian and the Sunday Times. I mean, such different newspapers in the heyday of newspapers.
And different audiences. So you had to sort of change your beat depending on who you were talking to.
To an extent. I tried to be very, very careful about that. I did not want to ever come across as if I spoke in one political voice somewhere and in a different political voice anywhere else. What I might do is some cartoons that were slightly, you know, of a slightly different kind.
Yeah.
But my political sus had to kind of run across everywhere that I was, because I didn't want any inconsistency.
Yeah.
Unlike
Musi Maimani, whose accent changes depending on who he's talking to. Do you remember that moment?
Oh, shame. You know, that's I actually do love code switching. And in a sense, I was code switching a little bit with some of the kinds of cartooning. So I do identify with that. But if Musi Maimani said different things politically to different people.
No, of course. Of course.
That would be the equivalent of my changing my stance.
Yeah, no. I get you. Can we do a little journey back? It was very cool of you to send us some voice notes. So we don't have to repeat too much of it now. But we've got this lovely way of getting a sense of you through the films that you've loved. Because our theory here at the Video Store is that, you know, these movies that you've loved across your life have helped shape who you have become. Where did we grow up?
I grew up in Cape Town, the first, like, my young years until age 7 were in Newlands, really on the slopes of Table Mountain. And, you know, just below the sort of walking area in Newlands Forest. And then we moved not far away, a couple of kilometers away, to Rondebosch.
Okay.
Still very much in that kind of southern suburbs, but out of the heavier rain. It's amazing how much more it rains right next to the mountain than a couple of kilometers away.
Yeah.
You know, there's a temporary inversion where the cloud comes from the sea and just rains like hell. And I was on the sort of Newlands Rondebosch, then growing up till, you know, right through school and till I, and even when I started university.
And so,
that's where I.
And some of the films that you loved, you quoted films like The Jungle Book, that got you started, eh? You were starting to doodle at that point.
Yeah, the very, very first one, I remember definitely the very first one that I saw of those Disney movies that made a massive impression was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I just, I was so, the you know, even how scary the cartoons and can be, you know, when you evoke a kind of another world, you can do some very, very powerful things with cartoons. I remember that very well. The next one I remember actually was Mary Poppins, which was also a combination of live action and cartoons, which is, I think, the first big movie that had actually done that. And then The Jungle Book, which I know a lot of people were very influenced by. It's an absolute classic, absolutely brilliant. Music was brilliant as well. And then I also remember A Boy Named Charlie Brown, because I was a huge Peanuts fan. I actually wanted to be an assistant for Charles Schulz. That was my ambition at one point, and to be an assistant for Hergé, who did Tintin. So the movie A Boy Named Charlie Brown came out in, which is also when I was, you know, before I was 10 or around about when I was 9 or 10 or something, and that was big.
But I think Peanuts must have also been important, because you could see that it was also drawn as well, not just a movie, like there was the strip. And I'm sure you consumed a lot of the strips.
I used to collect, in those days I used to cut everything out of newspapers, and then I started collecting the books that Charles Schulz produced.
Did you ever consume a lot of Calvin and Hobbes?
Oh yeah, but that's of course much, much, much later in terms of sort of formative years. That's well past my kind of formative years. Calvin and Hobbes was really a phenomenon in the 80s. He did it for like 10 years, and then he stopped it. But oh, he's a total genius. Yeah,
it's amazing how that guy Bill Watterson. Nobody knows what he looks like. he's a complete sort of ghost. It's really fascinating.
There's a very few pictures of him. He's a recluse. He didn't want Calvin and Hobbes to be sort of
commodified,
commercialized, monetized to an extent, but commercialized to the point that some of the other great strips like Peanuts had been. He didn't want all those products out there. He wanted to kind of keep it more kind of pristine.
Yeah.
And he went to paint with his dad. He's a good watercolorist, and he went. He and his dad sort of painted in the woods together after he stopped doing that. He's an unusual character.
Interesting. Yeah. Over into high school, where did we go to high school?
So, some of the movies that I saw still in primary school, my first James Bond, I remember very well, Dr. No, and the Charlie Chaplin shorts. And I remember seeing Papillon, which made a huge impression, and Stagecoach by John Ford. I went to and The Third Man. I remember those movies made some impression on me at that point. I went to primary school and high school at Rondebosch. So Rondebosch was high.
Okay.
And that's also where my nickname came from.
Okay.
From
where? How did that? Was that just based off your surname? What led to the nickname?
Yeah. It's good. So initially it was a nickname, and then it kind of became a pen name in a roundabout way. Because when I arrived in Standard 6, grade 8, there was a matric, a guy who was very well liked, and he was a good sportsman, and he was good academically. His name was Shapiro too, but spelled the Polish way. So that's S-Z. Like Shapiro, still pronounced Shapiro, but spelled S-Z-A-P-I-R-O. So people thought I was his brother. They started calling me Zap. And I, you know, already being a cartoonist, I was already doing drawings. And I thought, ooh, I'll sign my drawings Zap. So I figured out the first bit.
Yeah.
I did that little first bit that I do with the Zap. And I signed it like that for like 12 years. And then when I was doing cartoons for the at the front and for ECC, and then I was drawing some pretty hectic things. I remember drawing a policeman shooting someone dead, and I signed Zap, and I thought, ooh, that looks a bit sort of flippant.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe it's time that I actually made it a little more substantial. And I thought, well, how do I work with that little Zap thing that is an entity now? I sat for an afternoon figuring out how to pull the rest of my name in a way that looks like it lives in the same universe as the other letters.
Yeah.
And then by that afternoon, from then onwards, from 84, I started signing at Sabira. And it's incredible how this ordinary, I always call it a kind of common or garden surname, Jewish surname, Shapiro.
Yeah.
We so many, it's like Smith in the Jewish community, but the Shapiro is so different from it. It's only slightly, but people remember it, and it has a sort of, and it has a look and feeling that has been picked up a lot. Yeah,
it's lovely, man. Okay, so that was formed in high school.
Yeah,
it's lovely. What were some of your high school movies? Because that's always an interesting time when we start discovering other things, you know.
Well, I suppose I mentioned, you know, Puppy or Third Man and Stagecoach. Those are from high school. I became a huge Mel Brooks fan. I started loving certain kinds of comedy. So I remember seeing Blazing Saddles. I was blown away by Blazing Saddles. I also loved Young Frankenstein and Marty Feldman, that sort of thing.
I think the ability to make fun of something that already exists was probably the power that you got from a Mel Brooks. Like knowing that, you know, the mighty Star Wars could be dismantled by Spaceballs.
Yeah.
Even racism could be played with, you know, in Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles, yeah.
No one's safe. And so it makes sense that like a Mel Brooks has a big impression on you and help carve your commentary.
Yeah, in fact, what I also heard is not a movie, but a piece of stand up by Mel Brooks that made such a huge impression on me that I kind of memorized it. And as I think all kind of comics and cartoonists and stand up comedians and that are they're things that forge their way into the psyche. I mean, I haven't even talked so much about the books that did that for me, but speaking of Mel Brooks, the 2,000-year-old man is a piece of stand-up that he did with Carl Reiner, so where he's got a guy who's supposedly 2,000 years old who's being interviewed by Carl Reiner, who's the straight man, but he's this kind of, you know, sort of New York Yiddish accent kind of character, and hello, how you doing? You know, then they ask him stuff like, what was it like back then? Well, we didn't have jobs back then. I mean, we, you know, sit and look at a tree. That was a job. Good job. You couldn't get that job. And then he conflates. It's this crazy universe where he conflates sort of Neanderthal times with sort of 2,000 years ago biblical times, and then everything's it's all one big strange amalgam of crazy fantasy.
Was it a live show that was filmed?
Yeah, it was a live show that actually there are some filmed bits, but this is audio. I had it on a record, LP that I played over and over again to hear this style of comedy, and it made a big impression on me. Yeah,
lovely. Then you did some traveling overseas. You studied overseas. You were in New York, hey?
Yeah. Well, that kind of came after. I mean, that's jumping too far ahead from what happened was that at my high school time, I'll tell you as well that the other movies that I was into at that point were also the and now for something completely different, the whole Monty Python thing started to have a big effect later, you know, Life of Brian and this, the Holy Grail and things like that. Then Brazil was a big influence, and then later others. We can come back to those if you want, but what happened was that I wanted to become a cartoonist, but I was doing sort of academic subjects at school because I wasn't doing art. There'd been a terrible art teacher at the school. And just when we chose our subjects, a very good art teacher came. But by that time, I was doing Latin and physics and chemistry and biology and stuff like that. And I didn't change to art. I just carried on doing cartoons. But then I had to find some sort of profession, I thought. And I also had to stay out of the army. So I went to study architecture.
Oh,
and I was a crap architectural student because I was enjoying learning how to do drafting and do perspective and axonometric drawings. I was really one of the best at that, but I was kind of
the maths brain,
just not in terms with the theory of structures and with building construction and all. Yeah. I kind of wasn't interested.
Where was
and
that?
So, where was that? At UCT.
That was UCT. Okay.
And so I really wasn't handling it very well. But every year I'd get my deferment. I fell a bit behind with my architectural studies. Eventually, I did finish what turned out to be a degree. At that stage, architecture was like medicine. It was a long, long degree.
Yeah.
6 years. And what happened was that when in architectural fourth year, they encourage you to travel. So I went traveling and I decided to really get, you know, to go and find some cartoonists if I could to speak. So I wanted to meet Hergé, who did Tintin, and I wanted to meet Uderzo, who did Asterix. I was traveling in Europe. So the first I got to Paris and I tried to meet Uderzo. I got lost. I had his address from the Pompidou Center. I got it in my library. I got lost. And I ended up late, like, you know, half past 10, quarter to 11, trying to find his. So 5 to 11, I found his very posh apartment on the outskirts of Paris in autumn, nobody else around on the streets. And I had to decide whether I would ring his doorbell, unannounced.
Yeah.
5 to 11. This is a global superstar. Really.
This is at night.
At night.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I rang his doorbell at 11 o'clock at night.
Did he answer?
Yeah. He answered the door dressed in a suit. And my first was relief that he wasn't in his pajamas or naked or whatever, and that he didn't like shoo me away. And I said, I'm so sorry. I'm this scruffy kind of student with my backpack and I'm very tired and I'm totally lost. And I said, I'm so sorry. In those days, one didn't travel so much so easily.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
I've only been this way once, and I'm from South Africa, and I really would love to find out where people study cartooning. How do you do it in Europe? I'm really sorry to disturb you, but, and he said, entrez. So he invites me in.
That's lovely.
At 11 o'clock at night.
This is the guy behind Asterix, hey?
Well, there are two. There's Goscinny, the artist. And Uderzo, Goscinny, the writer, and Uderzo, the artist.
Okay.
And this was Uderzo.
This is the artist. Okay.
Absolute legend. So he doesn't just talk to me on the doorstep and swat me away. He says, entrez. I walk in. I said, geez, now what? And I suddenly realize he can't speak English and I can't speak French. His wife comes down the grand staircase in this duplex apartment, also dressed. They must have been somewhere. And he says something about Afrique du Sud, but I realize that he's like, he's not, this is going to be problematic.
Mm.
He's invited me in and like, it's embarrassing already. Now we can't communicate.
Yeah.
The door opens from outside and in comes his daughter. A young woman my age, turns out to be his daughter. She speaks good English, studying at the Sorbonne, and she then translates.
Oh, magic.
So it was amazing. And he said, have you got any drawings with you? And I said, oh, yeah. And I took him out of my backpack and he looks, he pages, he flips through and he says, très bien, très bien.
What a special moment.
And it made a massive impact on me. And I mean, I never forgot that. I never, ever forgot this huge figure, globally famous, was so kind to a rude late night young stranger, and gave me a hell of a lot of encouragement. So it's phenomenal.
That's so special. Who were some of the other encounters similar to that that you were able to to meet?
A day or two later, I tried to meet Hergé, and who was actually my real, the real, real hero from when I was really young. And I went to Brussels, and this time I actually managed to find his studio in broad daylight and sort of managed to get in. And then in the lobby, I just spent ages before I even rang the bell. I just spent looking at the phenomenal models and things that all came from Tintin, you know, the rocket and the various ships. And it was like a little museum in the lobby. And then I rang the bell, and this like cartoon character comes to the door, like some stepped out of Tintin, and he says hello, and he's got he's sort of baldish, and he's got kind of reddish hair sprouting from each side, and big round glasses and a big red moustache, and it's like, wow, an amazing character, a thin guy. He said, oh, I'm so sorry. He said, Hergé is not here, but he said, I'm Bob de Moor. I'm one of his collaborators. And it turns out he's one of the three great collaborators of Hergé. Okay. And Hergé was ill because he was old, and this is 1981. He died a couple of years later. Okay. So Bob de Moor takes me in and shows me around, and like, it was absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, I also had a wonderful experience there. So when I came back from Europe, I said to my parents, I'm sorry, I think you probably know, but I've got to quit architecture and become a cartoonist. Yeah. And they were hell of a supportive. Yeah. But the problem was, I started doing graphic design to become a cartoonist. And at that point, the army said, no, you're not getting deferment anymore. So okay. I got all the academic backup, and I tried, and eventually the army sent a big stamp saying, no, we're not hearing this case. I then get a letter in the mail saying, report for, congratulations, you've got a degree. So bizarre, at the same time as being rejected by my deferment being rejected by the army, I suddenly find I have a degree. Not that I know what I'm going to do with it, but it turned out to be very important later.
Okay.
Because I was able to study further. I was able to get a scholarship because I had a degree.
Yeah.
So it's a weird way around. Anyway, I had to go to the bloody army. If this was a visual podcast, I've got something that's sitting right next to me, which I would show you. I refused to carry a gun.
Yeah.
And I got in massive trouble, and I've got a very strange object, which was a kind of a lead pole with a rifle butt-shaped piece of wood attached to it,
given
to carry. And I even had to stand guard with this thing once because it was a very stupid corporal.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of funny stories from that period, kind of, which I won't go into now. But the point was, it then put me on this sort of this path of feeling like I'm here under protest. I'm going to subvert the system to some extent. I'll become a walking cartoon, and when I leave, I'm going to become a cartoonist activist. And that's what happened.
It's so lovely. Have you seen the film Hacksaw Ridge?
I have. Okay. And the beginning of Hacksaw Ridge is just like my experience.
Okay.
Of course, that guy was like a superhero in that what he wanted to do was to go into operational areas as a non-combatant medic and save people that way. So, I mean, from the early part is where I have a very close relationship with what happened with him. After that, I mean,
what's the term? Conscious objector. What's it?
No, conscientious objector is somebody like who refuses to serve. He wanted to serve, I didn't want to serve, but I didn't want to go to jail for 6 years.
Yeah.
Which in South Africa would have been, there would have been a 6-year jail sentence if I'd been a full conscientious objector at that point. So I kind of went in, gritted my teeth and said, okay, well, I'll be a conscientious non-combatant. Non-combatant.
Combatant.
Non-combatant. Yeah.
Where did you then go and study when you then did travel?
So then Well, then there's a big gap, because when I got out of the army, I felt I didn't have, I'd already been studying for 5 years. Actually, it's 5.5, because I spent half a year studying graphic design, and I was really doing well and before the army pulled me out. And I thought, no, well, by that time, the United Democratic Front had formed, and the ECC, and I'd got involved in those things. I got arrested while I was in the army, and the army sent military advisors to the military observers to the trial, and I had a tumultuous time in the army I was even sent on a top secret mission. Can you believe this? Like a guy who carries a joke rifle and can't do duties and is already putting Free Mandela stickers up in the office where I worked in the army, and they stupidly sent me on a top secret mission because I could draw, and they wanted me to draw stuff to present to the, you know, for budgetary purposes. And 2 weeks after that, I was arrested for the first time, which embarrassed all of them. And then they kept me away from anything like that ever again, which I was only too happy about.
The top secret mission? I mean, what was the idea of what you had to do? You don't obviously have to speak of what the mission was.
The idea was that the cabinet, the apartheid cabinet, was meeting in Namibia with the heads of the army, the navy, the air force, and the medics. To discuss budgets for all those different groups in the military, and so the military were pitching for budgets, and they wanted somebody who could like show the Navy, where I was on detached duty from the army, wanted me dressed in my brown uniform with my weird like non-existent gun. They wanted me to go up to fly up to Pretoria, which I did. With an assistant, but I was too like unpresentable to be taken to be briefed by the head of the. I didn't want to be there in the first place, but they didn't want me to be seen by the head of the Navy, this admiral. So they took a captain, and the captain said, it was really bizarre, it was like Kafka-esque. The captain said to me and my handlanger, "You stay here, like behind the door." Outside
and listen,
and I'll go in, I'll be briefed and listen, make sure you listen carefully. So the chief of the Navy like briefs the captain comes out and says to us, did you get that? So I said yes. Then we go into a little room and I draw Tintin style the most ridiculous things that the Navy would do, like blowing up stuff on the, you know, from strike craft going up the coast of Africa and things like that. And then I come back and I present that to my commanding officer, and she's very thrilled. And then 2 weeks later, I get arrested. And then she says, well, what? You're like, you put me in this embarrassing position. I said, I told you. I said, I'm not the guy to send on a top secret thing. So it was really bizarre.
That's amazing.
So I was going to say, when I got out, then I was still working for UDF and for ECC and for any other organizations and whatever. So I spent like a 5-6 year period being an activist cartoonist and doing my first cartoons for struggle newspapers and alternative press. And then I applied in 1987 for a scholarship, Fulbright, and I wanted to go to New York.
Okay.
And just before I was going to leave for my Fulbright, I got detained without trial by the security police because they thought I was on the Mandela birthday committee organizing for his 70th birthday in 1988. So it's a very strange turn of events. After his birthday, I wasn't on that committee.
I was about to say, were you or not? Okay.
No, I wasn't. But actually, there was a friend of mine with the same name, Jonathan Chaper, who was on that committee.
Ah.
And I didn't say anything. And then when I realized, I've been in solitary for not answering questions. And then I was in solitary for a while. Then I was still in detention. Then I got out after Mandela's birthday, go to study in New York, which I can talk about. But when I came back 2.5 years later, I go to a party in observatory in OBS, you know, where a lot of people I know hang out. There I see this guy, Jonathan Chaper, known as Jojo. I said, hey, judge, you know that they detained me because they thought I was you.
It's like a he big says, Lebowski no moment.
he says, no shit, while you were away, they detained me because they thought I was you.
Have you seen the Big Lebowski?
I have.
Yeah,
I have.
It's absolutely just such a great, like.
I love it. I mean, the Coen brothers are right up there.
Yeah. It's just such a confusing movie with mistaken identities. And that's lovely. Exactly. Oh, what a cool thing to happen.
I also like movies like Get Shorty and things like those. It's another kind of that genre of movie I really like.
It's a very frustrating movie, but in a very rewarding way. Where everyone just speaks over each other. They don't speak to each other. They speak at each other. It's lovely dialogue, but it's very frustrating to watch.
Yeah.
You were at RISD, hey? Where did you go?
No, I wasn't. I was at the School of Arts, SVA.
Okay.
In Manhattan.
Okay.
Which was my school of choice.
Good.
And I wanted to go there because Art Spiegelman was teaching there, or so I thought.
Okay, who's that?
And, you know, Art Spiegelman is the legendary underground cartoonist who then is sort of one of two people who are regarded as the co-creators of the genre of graphic novels or graphic long-form graphic journalism, the other one being Will Eisner.
Okay.
So Will Eisner was teaching at the school. Art Spiegelman, when I arrived, I went to sign up and they said, oh, no, sorry, he's not here anymore. He's too busy. He's out there. Art Spiegelman had done part one of this great book called Mouse, M-A-U-S, Mouse. It's a Holocaust story where Jews are mice, and it sounds banal, but it isn't. Mm. Jews are mice, and the Nazis, all Germans were, but the Nazis in particular, cats, the Poles are dogs, the Poles are pigs, the Americans are dogs, and it's but very codified. It's not Disney-fied at all.
Yeah,
it's very, very sort of, it's beautifully done. Okay. He won't, by the way, let this be filmed, and he just cannot comprehend of, and I think he's got a point. He does not want that genre of his to be filmed. There are others who've done, like Persepolis, who Marjan Satrapi has allowed her movie to be made into a very, her book to be made into a good movie, but Spiegelman wouldn't. So Spiegelman, I studied under Will Eisner for 2 years at the School of Visual Arts, and I later, in my second year, I managed to get an independent study with Spiegelman outside of the school.
Okay.
So that, I was really lucky. I studied under great people there.
And when your mind was being sort of blown open on this more global scale, were there movies at that point that stuck out for you at this formative time?
The two that I remember best from that period, the one was that Do the Right Thing, which is a seminal movie in so many ways. I mean, I think it's Spike Lee's best, and Spike Lee was all the rage in New York, and then we heard he was working on this movie, Do the Right Thing. And I was living in Spanish Harlem, so it like that's kind of very much this Hispanic part of Harlem, and you get the Upper East Side and above the Upper East Side. So I was living in 116th Street on the East Side, that's we walked the ten blocks up to Harlem proper. And. And at the Apollo Theater was the opening of this movie, Do the Right Thing. But I had been to the Apollo before, but the Apollo Theater, iconic and sort of very much the African-American thing. And there's this great movie opening. It blew our heads off. It's that thing of that, like we remember the device that he used, that Spike Lee used, was to have he had things about African Americans. There were some Koreans. There were some Hispanic people and some kind of Caucasian New Yorkers. And each of the four. And when they turn to the camera, and then the one had like the Korean has a rant about one of the other groups, and then the African American has a rant about the Hispanics or something. Each one does this once in the movie, and it was mind blowing. And So that was, I remember that, and I also remember seeing Jim Jarmusch's Memphis. Okay. And that whole kind of Rashomon thing of time, you know, it had been done a number of times, and originally, you know, Japanese, but that idea of same event being played again in different ways.
Different perspectives, people, yeah.
That really got me, I remember that.
Lovely. One of our last films that we look at is the film you could settle down with. This is because we actually categorize these films as the loves that you've had across your life, and I'm curious whether there's one that's like, or a few that's a bit of a comfort blanket, one that you've come back to many times, or you know you can always watch.
You know, actually. Two really that are kind of Terry Gilliam. I mean, the one that I remember when I was young that I saw, I must have seen it four times, was Brazil.
Yeah. No, it's come up before, and I need to watch it. I haven't seen Brazil.
So that's one. And then I do think that if I really had to watch a movie over and over and over and over again, I would go for another of his movies, Life of Brian.
Yeah,
I think that is, it's so profound in its silliness and its craziness. And you know, as somebody who's a secular humanist who is coming to massive under massive threat from religious groups of all kinds, I love the. It's a kind of philosophical and profound, as well as being just ridiculous and funny.
Yeah,
and its take on religion and how stupid all religious texts and all religious doctrines are. Yeah. I mean, absolute imaginary stuff that is like, and those of us who don't believe any of it are regarded as somehow being the outliers, the weirdos for not believing in stuff in the sky and voices and, you know, afterlives and whatever and whatever. And I just think that done in this hilariously funny and completely witty, brilliant way in that movie is, I think, total genius. And I could just watch that over and over.
That makes perfect sense, because obviously there's been a agenda for you. You're not just a comedian, you know, and of course this has gotten you detained and imprisoned and put in solitary confinement. And so obviously the politics and the sharp message is important, but you've chosen to convey it through humor more often than not. Obviously, there's been, and I think that's been the power, is that when the occasional Zapiro frame comes out that isn't humorous, it works because it's just so different to its others. But you use humor, so it makes sense that comedy has been so important in your life, and it makes sense that your ultimate comfort blanket is a comedy, because that is your go-to, right?
Yes, it's a comedy, but a profound one. I mean, I could have also done a couple of the Mel Brooks things, but I'm just going to go with The Life of Brian for now. But the thing, I saw one of the things from The History of the World, Part 1, the Mel Brooks, that little sequence the other day where Mel Brooks comes where he's Moses and he's speaking with God, and God says, Moses, and then Mel Brooks, like, he says something back to him, and he kind of jokes that he says, are you a bit hard of hearing? And God, like, what's that? God says, what's that? And Moses, he says, Moses, I want you to get these commandments that you've got to take to the people. Yeah. And Moses, all right. He goes around, he goes behind this rock. And he like comes out with these tablets. He's like balancing them, and you actually see that he's got three tablets there. And he says, "People of Israel, I got here something from God. I have these 15, and he swear one of the 10 commandments.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's so great.
Yes. So yeah, to your point, the being satirical and funny and irreverent about political and religious doctrine. That's exactly what I respond to. And And just the other thing that you were talking about, it's not always humor. What it is always surprise and a twist, because satire is about the twist, about twisting things and surprising things. Mm. So it can be funny, more often than not funny, but it could just be outrageous. It could just be cerebral, like making you think about something in a different way. It could even be sad, but it always, if it's going to work, it's got to, you see something and you expect something, and it's the unexpected way of looking at things that makes it good satire that somehow sits in your head.
Yeah, no, exactly. Oh, we can chat forever. But I'm gonna let you go, because I know that you've done a lot of interviews, especially around the film. So I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate all the visits to the Bioscope. I love the fact that you've been a part of it. I love the fact that I could be a part of some of the moments in your life where the Bioscope was the venue for Demo Crazy. We did another one of the annuals. We had you back recently for when Durban presented the Showerhead, and you're in our lobby every day with the books that we sell. So yeah, so just thank you so much. Just with my Bioscope hat on, just to say thank you for choosing us for some of those moments, and then of course just to enrich people with this film. You know, obviously you said, as you said, Craig, you know, assembled this document as a film, but you know, obviously it's you, it's your relationship with Zuma, and it's this incredible story. And as I said, we've got these artifacts, we've got almost these sort of week by week blows of how these stories played out, which we as South Africans really just need to always remember. So yeah, you're a national treasure in that regard, and it's just so, I'm so glad that the Bioscope has this document that we can keep screening.
Thank you. Thank you, Russell. By the way, you say I'm in your lobby every day. Most people tell me you're in my toilet every day. That's where they have my annuals. I said, that's fine. Yeah. But really, thank you so much for what you're doing for movies, what you're doing for having a place where, you know, like we have the Labia down here, and the Bioscope up there, what you're doing with is fantastic. I love it. I love the fact that I've been able to be part of it every now and then. And I really appreciate all that you're doing, you know, for movies and beyond that. So great. It's been great chatting with you.
Thanks. Yeah, because I know that the screenings of the film are not really happening too much in Durban. I don't think many of the cinemas have taken the Showerhead in Durban, because it's just a bit too much MK country. But it's just so great that we can do it here, and we had sold out screenings over the weekend. So it's people want to learn.
Yeah, what we haven't talked about is the rating
yes.
reversal.
Yes, let's talk about it quick.
Just to quickly say the two things, the protest in, you know, now you've mentioned that the protest in Durban at the screening at the Durban International Film Festival, there was a protest where somebody came into the movie house dressed in full Zulu regalia and started singing his lungs. I didn't see him because it was at the back, but tried to drown out the movie. And that's the... It's interesting that somebody thought that this is what he had to do in order to protest. I always say, like, protest, you know, all the time, no problem. Stand before and after, and in other places, whatever. Do your protest, but don't drown out another piece of art or what somebody said. That's not freedom of expression to say, well, just because this may be a protest movie, you know, that and you can drown it out. So I don't think that's right. The and weird thing was there were people inside the movie theater who joined in, and I think who were may have been young filmmakers or whatever who were there at the festival. So in KwaZulu-Natal, that's the sort of sense one gets.
And that was probably one of the first screenings of the film. So it's not even like this person could have even had the chance to have watched it. To have made up any kind of...
It was the first screening.
Yeah, so
it was the first of the movie.
So you don't even know what you're dealing with. It's one thing to have watched it, gone, okay, that point went too far. So in the next screening, I'm going to say something. But if you don't even know where it's going, it makes the protest more complicated. And then what was the rating issue?
So the rating issue, that's something that I must mention, and that was that when the movie was when it was announced that it would be screened in movie theaters as opposed to going onto a screening platform, there is the equivalent of the old censor board, this board that reviews these things and gives ratings. It exists. Unfortunately, it's closer the three people who reviewed The Showerhead are closer in their way of thinking to the old apartheid kind of restrictive silliness than I would have expected in 2024. And their ruling was appallingly badly reasoned. It was talking about protecting young people from language and from sexual violence and all that. Really, the most one could say in this movie is that it's implied sexual violence. Say, for example, in the Lady Justice cartoon, it's implied. There's nothing explicit, and it's in drawing and it's in metaphor. So it is so far removed from the idea of real sexual violence that kids are exposed to. I mean, you know, high school kids.
Yeah. So they came out of the gate with a 16 age limit. That's how it worked.
And on top of that, they also were trying to protect Zuma. It was a blatant political protection of Zuma, which is not their mandate.
Yeah.
Their mandate is to protect, to look for about young people, kids, see what they may need to be protected from. But they were saying it's prejudicial for young people to be exposed to pillorying of Jacob Zuma because he had occupied the office of the president. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is absolutely arse about face and roundabout and stupid.
Yeah.
And luckily, the tribunal that looked at this, they, I think, were quite embarrassed by the pathetic rating and the way it had been worded. And our lawyers, who were from Weber Wenzel, the same people who defended me in the lawsuits that Jacob Zuma brought against me, and they came up with very, very strong reasons why this should be overturned. And it's now been given a 13 SVL, so it's sexual violence and language. We would have liked 13 PG, just parental guidance, but it's absolutely okay that high school students can now see the movie.
Yeah, and this can be the history class in school. It can be, kids can come and watch this now. Yeah, so it's amazing that still rears its head, and that even in 2024, you are still fighting some level of government wanting to impact your freedom of speech. Yeah, it's interesting.
And I'll just say the last thing I'll say about that is that that what you said about my cartoons being about the movie being in school is what I focused on when I spoke with the lawyers, and what was a central part of the case in to overturn the original rating, and that is that they are familiar with the high school kids. They see my drawings in exam papers. They see them in their syllabus. It comes up in history, in art, in languages, in life orientation, in economics. My cartoons are used as a teaching tool across the country. So, I'm lucky. I love having that connection with the young people that I do through the cartoons.
Yeah.
But that actually was acknowledged by the tribunal, and that was one of the things that they also talked about.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed getting the notice from the distributors that the FPB, the Film and Publications Board, have issued a new age limit.
Yes.
It took great joy in updating all the screenings on our website to have the new age limit. So well done on that.
Excellent.
And just well done on everything. I'm just so glad that we've got this visual document now of your work. And I'm so glad there's another annual coming, which we'll add to our stock here in the gift shop. And and it's just been an honor to have had this relationship with you, even though it's, you know, these nights or afternoons every sort of few years. I'm really grateful that I've been able to get to know you and have this chat. So thank you for your time.
That's mutual. Thanks very much, Russell.
Okay. Lovely. And good luck with your deadlines.
Thank you.
I'll let you get back to it. Thanks so much, right. Jonathan.
Yes. Okay.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. All right. What a great chat. What a lovely dude.
Interesting guy.
I just love the idea of like top secret missions and like fucking, like what he's been privy to and yeah.
And the story of him just like going up to the house of the artist of the Asterix comics. Such
just
a great
knocking
story.
On the door.
Yeah.
And it's also such an old story. Like,
yes.
You know, and now in digital age, you would have contacted, there would have been PR, there would have been, you know, meeting invites, there would have been all this red tape where before there was none of that.
Yeah.
You could just
knock on the door. Amazing.
But it's lovely. And so, yeah, as we said, The Showerhead is screening at the Bioscope.
Yep.
We've got some really cool annuals and compendiums on sale in the gift shop.
Yes.
So at the very least, come through and complete your collections.
There you go.
But yeah, thanks. Were you what kept you busy while we were chatting?
I was just paging through all the Zapiro comics.
Lovely. Okay, magic. Thank you, guys. So our home base is thevideostore.co.za. You can see links to previous guests that we've had. We definitely need to update that.
Cool.
But there are a handful that are links. Otherwise, you just got to go back.
Mm.
But it's a lot of filmmakers, comics, actors, playwrights, theater folk. So there's a lot to enjoy. But if you really enjoy this and you enjoy us, come back on Tuesday.
Yes, definitely.
Because we're going to talk movies.
Hell yes.
Lovely. All right, G-Force, stay strong.
You too.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.